So Deb, I want to thank you not just for reading today, but for your message last week about self-compassion. I really appreciated you sharing some of your story about how you struggle with feeling worthy of care and of compassion, and to share that I struggle with this as well. I'm guessing a lot of other folks here might too. Yes? Maybe? In other churches, I might say amen. It's a really good practice to name that, right? And to lift up that struggle for ourselves, to name it so we might actually push back against this ridiculous but insidious idea that we have to be perfect to be worthy of love, like our hearts, right? Your words, Deb, inspired me to think about how my opinions about capitalism and consumerism have been formed partly out of recognizing how they've conspired to create those unhealthy opinions about myself. And then I read Imani Perry's book, Breathe, A Letter to My Sons. Pete, we should have the wisdom slide up the whole time, please. And I've been thinking, as I've been reading this book, I've been thinking all week, my God, if it is this hard for me as a white woman, who looks so much closer to the ideals we've been trained to believe are normal, to feel good about myself, how hard must it be for people who don't look anything like those ideals? So Ms. Perry begins her first chapter, entitled Fear, with two quotes. The first is from June Jordan. I am not wrong. Wrong is not my name. My name is my own, my own, my own. The second quote is, it must be terrifying to raise a black boy in America. And it's attributed, Ms. Perry says, to everybody and their mother and father too. So when she writes, I want you to be able to eat, to keep a roof over your head, to have some leisure time, to not struggle to survive. I want you to be appreciated for your labors and gifts, but what I hope for you is nothing as small as prestige. I hope for a living passion, profound human intimacy and connection, beauty and excellence. When I read those words, I think, isn't that what I want for my child? Don't we all want those for our children? And then I stop and I think, they're not all in a place to hope those things for our children, realistically. I remember how many more obstacles block some people's children's access to this. And this is the frame that I hope to continue to offer us to peek through this morning as we hear words from all of the sources, all of these people that you see in front of you.
Our second wisdom reading is from John Lewis, who lived from 1940 to 2020. Mr. Lewis, as I'm sure most of you know, was a civil rights leader and politician, best known for his chairmanship of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and for leading the march that was halted by political violence at the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, in 1965, a landmark event in the history of the civil rights movement that became known as Bloody Sunday. He participated in the freedom rides of the early 1960s and in the historic 1963 March on Washington, directed the Voter Education Project of the 1960s and 70s, and served in the U.S. House of Representatives for Georgia's 5th Congressional District from 1987 until his death. Here are some of the things he said in a 2013 interview for On Being. I think in our culture, I think sometimes people are afraid to say, I love you. But we're afraid to say, especially in public life, many elected officials or worldly elected officials are afraid to talk about love. Maybe people tend to think something is so emotional about it. Maybe it's a sign of weakness, and we're not supposed to cry, we're supposed to be strong. But love is strong. Love is powerful. The movement created what I like to call a nonviolent revolution. It was love at its best. It's one of the highest forms of love. That you beat me, you arrest me, you take me to jail, you almost kill me, but in spite of that, I'm still going to love you. I know Dr. King used to joke sometimes and say things like, just love the hell out of everybody. Just love them. When we went on the Freedom Ride, it was love in action. The march from Selma to Montgomery was love in action. We do it not simply because it's the right thing to do, but it's love in action. That we love our country, we love a democratic society, and so we have to move our feet.
So this moves me to resonate with the struggle for self-love and compassion in a different way. Mr. Lewis talks about how we love others from the perspective of a Black man who has been beaten by representatives of authority in the culture of white supremacy, physically beaten multiple times while standing up for the rights of his people. How do you talk about love? How do you even access love when that has happened to you? I think how so many Black leaders were and are people of faith, and I know that is not the only answer, but it's one that I am familiar with. Whether or not you believe that Jesus was the literal Son of God, whether or not you believe he even existed, it doesn't really matter. What matters is the narrative, the story of his life. Whether true or not, is a model for living in right relationship with each other, for creating what he has been said to call the kingdom of God here on earth, the kingdom of heaven here on earth. I find again and again the Christian liberation theology of our Black siblings to be the foundation for this kind of life. Jesus knew that his job on this earth was to remind people of our job on this earth, to create the kind of love that makes suffering impossible, to love the hell out of the world. That means for me, as I try to live out my Unitarian Universalist faith, and particularly the Universalist side of that faith that calls me to remember love at the center, for me, it means I have to think about what living out love calls me to do. How do I create love in action, as Mr. Lewis said? For Mr. Lewis and for Dr. King, I think it meant that too, but it meant that while they were being dismissed and threatened and abused by other humans. So I ask again, how does one stay grounded in love in those conditions? I think that the example offered by the Son of God, or simply a human who lived love under the worst possible conditions in his own life, working for freedom for the oppressed, was hugely powerful for them.
My next wisdom reading is several short quotes from bell hooks, who lived from 1952 to 2021. She was a distinguished professor in residence at Berea College and an author and social activist who is best known for her writings on race, feminism, and class. The focus of her work was to explore the intersectionality of race, capitalism, and gender, and what she described as their ability to produce and perpetuate systems of oppression and class domination. She published around 40 books, ranging from essays and poetry to children's books, as well as numerous scholarly articles, and she appeared in documentary films and participated in public lectures. These are two aspects of love that she shared in her book, All About Love, New Visions. Love is a combination of six ingredients: care, commitment, knowledge, responsibility, respect, and trust. As you go about your life, you can ask, the action I'm taking, does it have the six ingredients? The word love is most often defined as a noun, yet all the more astute theorists of love acknowledge that we would love better if we used it as a verb. I am often struck by the dangerous narcissism fostered by spiritual rhetoric that pays so much attention to individual self-improvement and so little to the practice of love within the context of community.
Oh my gosh, there's so much in there. I think of this as kind of the how-to portion of what we're trying to offer you today. Love is a verb. Love is a way of being, and we can be love by acting out of these six ingredients: care, commitment, knowledge, responsibility, respect, trust. What would it change in our lives if we were able to do this? What would it change in your life if you were able to do this? As we think about that, I have to remind us to go back to self-compassion. There is nothing wrong with us because we're not able to act out all of these six ingredients at the same time, all the time, every day.
Yeah.
Or even some of the time. We have to know ourselves worthy of receiving love based on these ingredients to be able to access them ourselves. And Ms. Hooks adds a caution. While self-love is educational, instructional, foundational, it is the means and not the end. When we forget that, we slide into self-focus, self-indulgence, into an inability to see beyond ourselves. This, of course, is supported by the hyper-individualism garnered by capitalism and consumerism and extractionism in our society. Living in love means to create a different spiritual rhetoric that, yes, we are worthy of love and we are here to build community when we know that, in which everyone can thrive.
Our last wisdom reading is from Dr. Howard Thurman, who lived from 1899 to 1981. Dr. Thurman was an American author, philosopher, theologian, mystic, educator, and civil rights leader, and he served as Dean of Rankin Chapel at Howard University and as Dean of Marsh Chapel at Boston University. Dr. Thurman co-founded the first major interracial, interdenominational church in the U.S., and he played a leading role in many social justice movements and organizations of the 20th century. His theology of radical nonviolence influenced and shaped a generation of civil rights activists, and he was a key mentor to leaders within the civil rights movement, including Martin Luther King Jr. This is a story of his early life that he included in his autobiography, With Head and Heart. It happened around 1915. Public education for Black children in Daytona ended with the seventh grade. Without an eighth grade, there could be no demand for a Black high school. And if by chance a demand were made, it could be denied on the ground that no Black children could qualify. After I completed the seventh grade, our principal, Professor Howard, volunteered to teach me the eighth grade on his own time. At the end of the winter, he informed the public school superintendent that he had a boy who was ready to take the eighth grade examination and asked permission to give the test. The superintendent agreed to let me take the test, but only on the condition that he examine me himself. I passed, and a short time later, the eighth grade level was added to the Negro Public School. There were only three public high schools for Black children in the entire state of Florida, but there were several private church-supported schools. The nearest to Daytona Beach being Florida Baptist Academy of Jacksonville. A cousin who lived in Jacksonville told my mother that if I enrolled in the academy, I could live with him and his wife, doing chores around the house in exchange for a room and one meal a day. When the time came to leave Jacksonville, I packed a borrowed old trunk with no lock and no handles, roped it securely, said my goodbyes, and left for the railway station. When I bought my ticket, the agent refused to check my trunk on my ticket because the regulations stipulated the check must be attached to the trunk handle, not a rope. The trunk would have to be sent express, but I had no money except for a dollar and a few cents left after I bought my ticket. I sat on the steps of the railway station and cried my heart out. Presently, I opened my eyes and saw before me a large pair of work shoes. My eyes crawled upward until I saw a man's face. He was a Black man, dressed in overalls and a denim cap. As he looked down at me, he rolled a cigarette and lit it. Then he said, "Boy, what in hell are you crying about?" And I told him, "If you're trying to get out of this damn town to get an education, the least I can do is help you. Come with me," he said. He took me around to the agent and asked, "How much does it take to send this boy's trunk to Jacksonville?" Then he took out his rawhide money bag and counted the money out. When the agent handed him the receipt, he handed it to me. And then without a word, he turned and disappeared down the railroad track. I never saw him again.
Love in action. So you may have figured out by now that you're hearing a lot more words of people who are not me, and that's on purpose. There are so many things to be said that these folks and many, many, many other folks are saying and have said for centuries that I cannot expand upon, improve on. It's all there for us. So in that understanding, I'm going to talk a little bit about the Reverend Dr. Otis Moss III, who is the senior pastor for the United Trinity Church of Christ in Chicago, the church that Barack Obama attended and that Jeremiah Wright pastored. Reverend Dr. Moss has spent the last two decades there practicing and preaching a Black theology that unapologetically calls attention to the problems of mass incarceration and environmental justice and economic inequality. He's an NAACP Image Award recipient, an award-winning filmmaker, a poet, a professor of homiletics, and a husband and a father. Dr. Moss's work centers love and justice as inseparable parts of the foundation of his Christianity. And one of the sources for that theology is this story from Dr. Howard Thurman that Deb just shared with you. Dr. Moss says what I want to close with beautifully. And so I'm just going to share a little bit of what he has to say about this story from his book. He wrote, "The stranger at the station helped young Howard see himself as the hero in the dream of a better life for both himself and his people. In that, it was a story of justice. But at the same time, it was a story of love. The extraordinary power of that story derives from the way it combines love and the struggle for justice. It would have been loving, but not an act of justice, for the stranger at the station to speak kindly to young Howard, to buy him a meal or walk him home. But the danger of love without justice is that it becomes sentimental, even appeasing. Had young Howard and his benefactor shared a meal together, they might have felt better for a day about their lot under Jim Crow, but it would not have prevented further suffering. Love without justice would have taken no lasting action, brought no change. On the other hand, it would have been the beginning of justice if the stranger at the station had cursed the ticket holder, found a way to inflict on him the same measure of pain young Thurman experienced, and gone to join the political fight against the cruelty of racial segregation. But justice without love can become ruthless, an eye for an eye. That kind of justice risks continuing the cycle of hatred and reprisal that can tear down a community. Justice without love destroys. It was the combination of love and justice that set young Howard Thurman, his future student Martin Luther King Jr., and the American Civil Rights Movement on a path toward the light." Dr. Moss continues later in this chapter, "We have had the opportunity to link love and justice in any situation in which a wrong has been done. If a child has broken a rule or gone in a direction a parent does not desire, yelling and grounding will achieve a measure of justice. But if your goal as a family member or a teacher is more than simply measuring out the accepted dose of punishment, that is, if you care whether the child repairs what is broken and returns to a better path, then you need to plan and explain a lesson the child can use. Your justice needs to be linked with love. May it be so. May we be so."